Snow again last night, and the branches of the lilac bushes are all edged with white against their black delicacy. The roof of the house behind us has a perfect cap of snow, the telephone and electric wires, too. The birds are quick and darting in the still yard. A cardinal's bright red is a cheerful shock of color. This is Lucy's last school year at home. She'll be leaving for college in the fall. The other day I was walking by an office building that has a daycare center on the first floor, with floor-to-ceiling windows, and the blinds open so that I saw a little girl, about 2, with a lock of hair sticking out from her barrette, who looked just like Lucy used to look. I felt a stab of pain for the past. The Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh, whose books I so admire, writes, "Celebrate impermanence." Because, of course, if things didn't change, children would never grow up, our lives would not progress, and I wouldn't have the freedom I'm about to have, and yet I can't help longing for the past at times. As I walked along in the sunlight, I thought of Lucy at daycare, of Matt at a daycare back in Vermont when I was a single mother. The road up to his daycare was gravelly and bumpy, and each morning when I drove him there before I went to my job as a secretary, I would sing, only because it had the words bumpy road in it, "We will never, never meet again on the bumpy road to love." But at that time, I had no idea how fast all of those ordinary days would pass. I have been providing social work services to the patients of an oncologist, and I made a hospital visit today to a woman, a poor fellow creature, imprisoned in her body, and until later, after I saw how a pain pill smoothed out her face, and even by the time I left brought a smile, I hadn't realized how wild her face looked when I first arrived, like a horse thrashing in its stall. She was desperate to talk, despite the effort it cost her, and she began at once, as soon as I crossed the threshold into her room. In a hoarse whisper, hard for me to hear, she began, "Don't you think it's terrible to have to be like this?" And seemed relieved when I at once replied, "Yes, I do. It must be really terrible for you." She can move her head back and forth and talk, but she's paralyzed and incontinent, has to be fed and toileted, has spent the past few years in bed, and now tumors have spread so that she's swollen all around her head. Her ears are grotesquely squashed. "Do you know what it's like to sit in blood?" she asks. She tells me of being left unattended during her menstrual period in another facility. "It was like being in prison," she says. At night there, she felt totally cut off from the world. So she got herself out against medical advice, but her husband blames this for her lack of progress. She's troubled by the worry that her son, a young adult, still needs her and she must try to stay alive for him. Yet she tells me what it's like for her to fall asleep and keep waking up to the same intolerable physical condition. I ask her if she wants her family to let her go, and she answers, "I'm not sure." I ask her if I may touch her arm for a moment as I sit by her bed, and she nods, and then tells me a long story of how she tried to tell her husband that being touched was more an expression of love than sexual intercourse. When I say, "So is that to tell me you like my touching you?" she nods and says, "It shows you really care." Her pain has increased, though, and her cruel itching begins. I call in the nurse, who gives her tons of pills and water with a straw, but a few minutes later the patient suddenly begins to cough. I move away as she says she's going to throw up and step outside the room and call the nurse. This poor soul vomits, unable to turn over, and has a bowel movement at the same time. A crew of 2 women aides clean her up, and after a bit I'm allowed back in. She didn't throw up her pain pill. I checked that with the nurse. So when I return, she's calm. She even smiles at me. All the time she talks, She kept saying my name as if invoking a spirit. Growing up, I got little, if any, encouragement to use my talents in the outer world. The outer world, or that's how I think of it, belonged to others, mostly men. So, like many women, I made the most I could of the inner world. The world of caring for others' bodies, is mainly done by women who work as nurses and nurses' aides in hospitals and nursing homes. Even in my writing, which has largely been about the needs of children and women, my primary focus has been caring for others. I value my work in human terms, but it's not valuable to the society in monetary terms. And despite the obvious value to others of my work as counselor, for me, after a decade as a social worker, I'm beginning to wonder if it's good for me to be so immersed in others' troubles. As a mother, I've been caring for my children for over a quarter of a century, and I think I'm nearing a time when I need to be caring for myself. But this precious last year that Lucy's home, I'm grateful to be able still to care for her. She'd asked plaintively, "Are you going to be home tomorrow?" and had turned down a babysitting job, saying, "I want to spend the day with Mom." So we went to the Pancake House, where every so often when she was in high school, we'd go to spend a hooky day. Then we stopped at the car place to have a wobble fixed, a bad tire it turned out, and we browsed in the showroom while they fixed the tire. I pretended I'd buy her a car. "Which one would you like, dear?" She thought the black Mustang convertible. Then we went to actually buy her something, 3 bras at Victoria's Secret. When I was Lucy's age, nice girls wore only plain cotton underpants. I'd only heard whispers about the Fredericks of Hollywood catalog, but never seen it. And now everyone's daughter wears the kind of sexy underwear that was only hidden in plain brown wrappers in my day. Lucy and I strolled about the mall with our arms linked, laughing a lot. Before she went out that evening, she stopped in my study. "I love you so much," she said. "I don't know what I'd do without you." I put my arms around her. "You'd manage," I said. "You will manage. By that time, you'll have a family of your own." "I know," she said, "but I'd be so sad forever." "When I was your age," I said, those immortal mother words, "I had only a few more years of my mother, but I don't smoke anymore. I don't drink. I take good care of myself. I hope to be around for a long, long time." In the car earlier, after we'd gotten her new glasses frames, she thanked me, said, "Thanks, Mommy. You're such a good mother." I'd looked at her, pleased, but a little skeptical of the praise, quizzical. "You know that, don't you?" she said. "You're the best." I didn't know then how some years later I would hold those loving words close to me, how I'd need to remember she'd said them, felt them, because she was to tell me everything I had ever done wrong. I dreamt that I dropped, upside down, a leather carrying case full of precious jewelry inside a jewelry store. I wasn't sure I even knew all of what had been in the case, and therefore what now was lost, stolen, or ruined, as there was no control over who was coming and going in the store, and were they even looking where they were stepping? I think most of the jewelry was fragile or broken, but I wanted to save it so I could reset it. I guessed I'd never recover what I had spilled. Lucy and I are the same height and weight. I sat in her room as she packed for college, and I'd already begun getting the great pile of laundry ready, all the bedding for the peculiarly student-sized dormitory bed, the towels, the plastic carry-all for the communal bathroom. Lucy is leaving, never to live at home again. Only home for summers, I hope, and visits. We've taken Lucy to college in New York City. All of it was awful for me. Ben and I quarreled about how to get her there. He wanted to drive, but riding in the car makes me so anxious, I wanted to fly. And we did fly. We got a hotel room in order to get Lucy set up at school, but we quarreled there, too. I know that much of it was our nerves, each of us, in his and her own way, nervous and unsettled about having to let Lucy go. At the high iron gate of her campus, I made a joke that wasn't really a joke and held on to her, saying, "I won't let you go," as she laughed and pulled away. About half an hour after we'd said goodbye, Ben and I were sitting, gloomy, in a restaurant near the campus, and we saw Lucy striding right by on the sidewalk, looking excited. Ben and I turned and just looked at each other. At home, days later, having left my once-upon-a-time baby, Lucy, at college in New York City, left her in that giant, noisy, incomprehensible, faraway place. In the bathroom of my favorite coffee shop, I suddenly bury my face in my hands because I miss Lucy's bright presence and our laughing. I feel as I imagine I would feel after major surgery. When she calls a few days later, missing us, I come upstairs to what had been her room, and instead of feeling full of our new life, Ben's and mine, the upstairs feels only empty of the old, which I want back. The sound of her feet, her precious weight, moving overhead from downstairs. I try to understand that a daughter needs to get away from her mother. In my training as a clinical social worker, I learned about stages of human development, but it's not what I ever felt as a daughter. I never had enough of my mother's attention to want to get away from her. She nearly died my first year at college and was sick from then on. And then she did die when I was 28. I always wished I'd had more of her, not less. I'm having coffee upstairs in my study, stirring into the delicate china cup with a bird on it that Ben gave me, that brown, large crystal sugar that we had in Italy. I hear the sounds of kids on their way to school and feel a big pang for Lucy, for the past. When Lucy was home, my life, so much of it, was centered around her, what she did, how she was, where she was. Even once she was old enough to be left alone, even after she was out much of the time, despite my jobs, my writing, Ben's and my trips, Lucy remained a kind of center. I couldn't just hunker down on myself, how I am, how I feel, where I am. This blessing of privacy and freedom comes at the cost of missing her. But I remind myself it's time for her to be gone. We experienced the 17 years of home and school, the friends over for the night, the PTA, the science fairs, the school conferences, bikes, ice skating lessons, the lipstick in junior high, the first year of high school, and the last. The metamorphosis from gap-toothed girl in Smurf glasses to young woman. We had it all. We appreciated it all. Now it's someone else's time for that, and our time for this. For the phone calls telling us about a class or why she needs more money, for hearing the names of her new friends, for laughter at her description of a young man wrapped in a toga shorter than she is, making a bid for her attention, for looking forward to the pleasure of seeing her at the holidays, and for savoring the pleasure of her accomplishments as she flourishes. So this childless morning, this Monday, as other mothers' children return to school and I hear their voices outside the window, I rise at my own pace, make a pot of coffee to put on a tray, and turn my attention away from those years of nurturing two children to the new and exciting task of nurturing another young girl from the past, myself, who at 10 and 12 would draw and paint, create poems and songs, try to write stories. I'm going back to her to pick up the stitches I dropped.